principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future, with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Dr. Gertrude Himmelfarb is an author and educator who teaches courses in history in the graduate program of the City University of New York. Dr. Himmelfarb was educated at Brooklyn College and at the University of Chicago, where she earned a Ph.D. Dr. Himmelfarb specializes in English and European history of the 19th and 20th centuries. She has received fellowships and awards from the Rockefeller and Guggenheim Foundations, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the American Council of Learned Societies. Dr. Himmelfarb is a member of Phi Beta Kappa, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the Society of American Historians, and the Royal Historical Society. Dr. Himmelfarb's books include Lord Acton, A Study in Conscience and Politics, Darwin and the Darwinian Revolution, Victorian Minds, and On Liberty and Liberalism, The Case of John Stuart Mill. Dr. Himmelfarb, it's a pleasure to have you at the National Humanities Center, and welcome to our radio program, Soundings. One of your current interests is the writing of a book on the history of the idea of poverty, isn't it?
What about the current view of poverty? I mean, is there a world notion of poverty, as opposed to your work, a 19th century view of poverty?
I came to my historical problem by way of a very real, very urgent contemporary problem that you do know no historian normally confesses to. You're not supposed to come to history by way of current concerns. You are probably too young to remember a book that was very influential, 20 years ago, by Kenneth Galbraith, called Affluent Society. Do you remember that?
I remember the title.
Yes,
sure.
Well, it created a very great stir at the time. And it was very interesting. It was, it came out around 1958, perhaps 57. And the thesis, you remember, was that that was what America was suffering from. That was our dominant problem, the problem of affluence, so the wastefulness of our economy, the ostentation, and so on. It was unaesthetic. Mm-hmm. It was immoral. It was altogether objectionable, and that was what was happening to America, and this is what he was objecting to. The problem of poverty didn't really seem at all important. There were little pockets of poverty, Galbraith said at that time. I can't remember whether he invented that term, but I think that he did use it. But basically, there was no serious problem of poverty. And in passing in that book at that time, and this is 1958, he had some very interesting statistics. Let me remember how they went. The bottom 10% of the population, of families that is, had a combined income that was the equal of 1% of the total national income. Okay, the bottom 10% had 1% of the total income. The top 10% averaged, that is each family in that top 10% averaged 27 times the income of the bottom 1%. You shake your head. That sounds pretty appalling to you, right? From Galbraith's point of view, this didn't look so bad, and this did not constitute the problem. As I say, the problem of America was affluence. I mean, it was affluence that gave the society its peculiar quality. And it was that we had to confront, or else, you know, we would be in a very bad way. The book went through many revisions in the 60s. The second edition came out in the '70s, I think perhaps 1977, which gives a nice span of two decades. He has other definitions there. Other statistics there. He doesn't give the earlier ones. He simply updated the statistic he had earlier used, so that we have the bottom 10% of the population having 2% of the national income, remember, as against 1%, and the top 10% averaging 14 times as much, instead of 27 times as much, as the bottom. Now, you and I would say that sounds like an improvement, right? Instead of which, the thesis of that revised book was that poverty had emerged once again as a serious national problem. The maldistribution of income was outrageous. Things were getting better, not worse. All the policies of the 60s and 70s had not helped control or mitigate that terrible maldistribution. An extraordinary redefinition of poverty. But that in itself isn't all that remarkable. That kind of quantitative redefinition happens all the time, and it should happen. You know, people have raised expectations, standards of relative deprivation change, and so they should change, so that the quantitative raising of that line isn't all that remarkable. But at the same time in the 60s, you had something else going on, which for me was even more interesting, and that is a kind of qualitative redefinition of the idea of poverty. And I don't know whether you remember that, Edward Banfield wrote a very influential book called The Unheavenly City, in which he spoke of the emergence of a lower class that constituted the social problem. And what he called an underclass, I think.
Any connection with the so-called heavenly city of the philosophers?
Obviously, sure. Yes. This was an ironic commentary on that. Yeah. This was what was happening to our civilization. Remember, the theory of the heavenly city was an onward and upward progress. Yeah. Things would get better and better. The Enlightenment would take over and so on. And this, in fact, was what, in the real city, in the unheavenly city, this is what we were confronting, this terrible problem of the underclass.
But what was the qualitative change in the attitude toward poverty?
Well, because previously it had been assumed that the poor were a class in society, and that the poor were sharing in the benefits of society. Their income was getting rather better, the standards of living was getting better. They were progressing as society progressed.
Is this the filtering down thesis?
Right, essentially that's it. Right, which goes way back to Adam Smith, who started it, and which seemed to be working. I mean, from any quantitative point of view, it was certainly working. I mean, if you look at Galbraith's quantitative statistics, it would suggest that that was working. Nevertheless, something seemed to be happening. There was this class that seemed to have no relationship to the rest of society. A totally alienated class. Their values were quite different. Their sense of morality was different. Their family structure was different.
It wasn't just money.
Precisely. It wasn't money at all. In fact, they could even have more money than others and yet be members of this underclass. And at the same time, Oscar Lewis, who you ask about, you know, what was happening internationally and so on, and the same thing is happening everywhere.
He was looking at Mexican people.
He was looking in Mexico, and he was looking at Puerto Rico. And in the course of the 60s, I can't remember the exact dates of the book, but he must have come out with 3-4 books on families in both Mexico and Puerto Rico. And there, and then he coined the term, or if he didn't coin it, he popularized the term culture of poverty. And again, it was something qualitatively different about that culture.
And this is what you're examining now.
And this is really what I'm examining. You read this literature, and my God, well, as far as I'm concerned, I'm back in England in the 19th century, where we had exactly that notion of an underclass. The current terms are fascinating. The contemporary terms, the 19th century terms, the Victorian terms, the residuum. Really, I was about to say it's ironic. It isn't ironic. It's significant.
Well, I remember dust is a term that crops up. And dust, I was going to ask you about Dickens' novels. Is this the sort of thing that he's attacking in Dombey and Great Expectations and Bleak House?
Right. The dustman, remember, our mutual friend, I think, the dustman. Dust, in English, by the way, means garbage.
Mm-hmm. Trash.
Yes.
Trash.
Yes.
Well, contrast some of these qualitative differences then, or compare them, our attitudes toward poverty and the way we look at people who don't have a lot of money and think that it's just money alone, and the attitude of the Victorians. You're suggesting that we're running a parallel here, huh?
We have recently, I think. Uh-huh. I think something in the past 20 years, I think, has decisively changed in our own conception of poverty.
What's that?
Let's take it back a little bit. If you go back to for most of human history, I think well into the 19th century, poverty is regarded as a perfectly normal and natural and inevitable condition.
The poor are always with us.
The poor are always with us. And what it means to be poor is simply means you have to work. Poor means worker. So that in all of the early literature, I mean modern literature is modern by the historian's standards, 16th, 17th, 18th century. The poor are equivalent to the people, meaning the masses of the people. Sometimes the words will be the laboring people, or the laboring classes, or the lower classes, or the lower ranks, or the lower orders, or something of that sort. Those are the poor. Everybody's poor. Everybody's poor unless you have a profession or an income. But if you're dependent upon your labor for your subsistence, you are poor. It's for almost all of history. It isn't until you get to the 19th century that you get a highly different. And of course there are problems. And the main thing, the thing that interests me, is the fact that the poor are not problematic. Poverty is not a social problem. It's nothing you have to do anything about. No more than you do anything about, what, death or work, the necessity to work. There are problems in poverty, and, you know, the Elizabethans knew that, and they took care of it. There's the problem of the aged and the sick. And people who could work but who couldn't find work, or people who were able to work but didn't want to work, that was a great category. But this could all be taken care of in rather small ways, and these didn't constitute permanent groups within the body of the poor. Because obviously people were aged at one point of their lives, but this didn't make you a class within the poor. Mm-hmm. And as I say, they were taken care of in various ways, and by the way, very humanely for a good part of modern English history at any rate. I think it's rather a little different on the continent, but England was for the most part very, very humane about these things. And this goes right on into the 19th century, and it isn't until you reach the 19th century that you get differentiated groups within the poor.
And what are they?
Well, the paupers, for example, get separated out from the poor. The dependent poor, as opposed to the independent poor. The respectable poor is against the unrespectable, the deserving poor. Remember in Dickens, you find that all the time, the deserving poor as opposed to the undeserving.
They practically wear halos.
The deserving do, that's right. Yeah. And the reason they wear halos is because it's very important to distinguish them from the undeserving. This becomes very important in the middle of the century. And when you define the poor in those terms, then simultaneously you are creating a class of poor that is a problem, as opposed to another class that is not a problem. And you watch all the social policies there. You create that social problem, so to speak. You decide that pauperism is a social problem. And so you have a whole structure of poor laws and workhouses and so on to take care of pauperism. Or the dangerous classes are a social problem. And so there's a great deal of talk about crime and about prisons, and there are penal reforms and so on. And again, they're trying to handle it as best they can. I'm not suggesting that there's anything necessarily inhumane about it. On the contrary, they are trying to handle it, but they are handling it in those terms. And it is not until as late as 1880 that the poor become undifferentiated again, and that for the first time, poverty itself becomes a problem.
Why is that?
Why is that? That's my problem. Why does that happen? And one can give all kinds of reasons. You can say, that it's at that point that the Industrial Revolution has reached a point where it has created an objective problem which has to be taken care of. The difficulty with that is that there's always been that objective problem before and after the end, and every every moment in the course of the Industrial Revolution, for a whole century, there's been that kind of objective problem. And yet it hasn't been regarded as a problem and hasn't been treated as a problem.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Dr. Gertrude Himmelfarb is a writer and teacher in the graduate program in history in the Graduate School of the City University of New York. Dr. Himmelfarb earned degrees at Brooklyn College and at the University of Chicago, where she did her PhD studies. She specializes in the scholarship and teaching of English and European history in the 19th and 20th centuries. During her career, she has received awards and fellowships from the Guggenheim and Rockefeller Foundations, the American Council of Learned Societies, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Dr. Himmelfarb is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the Society of American Historians, the Royal Historical Society, and Phi Beta Kappa. Dr. Himmelfarb's books include On Liberty and Liberalism, The Case of John Stuart Mill, Lord Acton, A Study in Conscience and Politics, Victorian Minds, and Darwin and the Darwinian Revolution. Dr. Himmelfarb, it's a pleasure to have you participate in a discussion here at the National Humanities Center. Your current interest is in the writing of a book on the history of the idea of poverty, and one of the subjects you treat is unemployment and the unemployed. Could you talk about that?
Unemployed appears way back. I mean, you get that in Elizabethan literature and all the way through the 16th and 17th, 18th centuries.
But it doesn't have the social connotation.
Exactly. Unemployed mean people. Mm-hmm. People who, for one reason or another, at one time or another, happen not to have jobs. Mm-hmm. In the 1880s, for the first time, unemployment appears as a noun, which suggests that it is an objective condition. It's not the people who constitute the problem. Unemployment is an objective condition. It's a condition that is now a problem. And immediately on the heels of that, you get all kinds of proposals for coping with unemployment. Industrial camps and labor camps and unemployment insurance at the turn of the century and so on. But it's not until unemployment gets defined as a problem that you get solutions designed to cope with unemployment.
So we have to say these things to ourselves before we begin to understand them.
Before we begin to understand, you know, what is happening and why is it happening. Now, again, the ordinary social historian will come along and say, well, look, why are you creating this problem? Unemployment emerged as a problem because it became a problem at that time. It had always been unemployment. In the 16th century, the vast enclosure movement had created an enormous amount of unemployment among the agricultural laborers. It's interesting, by the way, it hadn't occurred to me until just this minute. Those people who were so badly affected by the enclosure movement of the 16th century fed the ranks of what were then called rogues and vagabonds and sturdy beggars. They were the people who roamed the countryside because they had no work. Mm-hmm. Well, you can see the moral connotations that attached.
Sure, and there was a whole literature that grew up around them.
Enormous literature. The 18th century had an unemployment problem in the same sense. Even industrial unemployment was not uncommon. We knew all about that, the 1820s and 30s and all those silk weavers in England who were in a terrible state, terribly depressed state. So it is not the objective condition that appears for the first time and therefore requires a word to categorize it or to describe it. Mm-hmm. It is something else that is happening. And I think that something has to be thought of in terms of ideas, which is why my book is not on a history of poverty, it's a history of the idea of poverty. As soon as you say that, you discover that a major factor in that conception, perception, image, whatever, is morality.
If poverty is a moral notion, or if it has a moral dimension to it, we must be in trouble today, huh?
When the problem is unemployment instead of the unemployed, what we have done is shift the focus from individuals, obviously, to somebody else. There is that condition. And the condition is no longer the responsibility of the individual. It's the responsibility of something else, in this case of society or the economy or whatever, or capitalism maybe, however you want to define it. But that notion of a moral responsibility for one's own fate or for one's own condition, at that point diminishes. And what we have done in the course of the 20th century, I think, mm-hmm. is precisely to eliminate as much as we can. It's very hard to do entirely, by the way. I think human beings have an instinct and a need for moral categories. So it's very hard to do it. But we've tried desperately to eliminate any moral connotation attached to poverty. By the way, again, poverty is another one of those words. Now, that word existed in the language, but it was rarely used. I mean, the problem was always the problem of the poor. Now, again, it wasn't meant necessarily in any invidious sense. That is, the poor could have problems for all kinds of reasons, reasons within their control, in which case they were regarded as responsible moral agents and they must take responsibility for their poverty, but also reasons outside of their control. So they could get sick, and this obviously wasn't, you know, a willful act on their part. But it was the poor, and so there was always a sense, and when one tried to solve that problem of the poor, one tried to do it in such ways as not to undermine their morality, not to, the famous expression in the 19th century is not to demoralize the poor. The great worry was that any system of relief might demoralize, it might make it more attractive for them not to work than to work. But you see, once the problem gets defined as poverty, mm-hmm. then it's not the responsibility of the individual at all. We have eliminated the moral reference from that word.
Because we describe it as poverty.
Yes, yes.
Rather than the notion of individual agency.
Right.
Well, how do we climb out of this?
Well, we've tried. I think social policy has uh-huh. tried desperately, and I think the whole culture, the whole climate of opinion has tried very hard to eliminate any moral referent in the mm-hmm. idea of poverty. As I say, I think human beings can't quite do without it. In fact, we do have residual sense in which individuals are responsible moral agents and they are not necessarily the victims of society or social change or social force or whatever. And so every now and then it gets reasserted, but we've tried very hard. I mean, mm-hmm. look at our social policies, all of which are designed to be non-invidious, not to make any reflection on the recipient. I'm not criticizing this, mind you. I'm, you know,
policies, for instance,
well,
to do with
Social Security, for example.
Or abortion.
These are now acceptable. We are not supposed to describe them or judge them or whatever.
They are just there.
They are there. They're mm-hmm. there, and they are to be. People are to avail themselves of it, just the way they avail themselves of unemployment insurance.
On an individual basis.
Yes, that's right. But it's never a reflection on the individual that he, well, in this case, she, mm-hmm. Should choose to do that.
Well, where is this leading us?
Well, my own prediction is, as I say, I don't think society can live with this. I don't think we can live with it.
What's going to
and
happen?
I think there's going to be a reaction against it. I think it's already happened in crime, for example. Remember, there was a long time when crime somehow wasn't the responsibility of the criminal.
Yeah.
And we tried desperately to accommodate ourselves to that, to be liberal and to be progressive and to be enlightened and so on.
In the same sense that a kid who can't write, it's not his fault,
right,
it's the fault of...
Right. Literacy, that's a very good example. I hadn't thought of that, but that's exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I think it's beginning to be recognized even now. And the great paradox, of course, is that it comes out of the same impulse that made us value the individual so much. It was the same kind of liberalism mm-hmm. that permitted us to assign very great value to the individual. And individuality, of course, you know, was one of those cherished words. One mustn't impinge upon the individual, upon the individual's individuality, mm-hmm. and one mustn't interfere with it, and one mustn't have any social sanctions that would repress it or whatever.
So it's a problem of excesses.
As soon as we carried that notion of liberty to that extreme point, we opened the door to exactly the opposite idea, because there were no controls and because everything seemed permitted and so on. It's exactly at that stage where controls rush heavily in to fill the vacuum.
That notion of individual liberty taken too far, taken to an extreme, mm-hmm. leads us to the world of I'll do my own thing, and mm-hmm. don't bug me, I don't bug you.
Right.
But so basically your diagnosis is that we're headed in the right direction.
Well, I think
so. Because we're going to get back to individual.
I think so. I think there is a kind of natural corrective in these matters.
Mm-hmm.
Pornography is a very good example. I do remember one couldn't touch pornography. If you suggested that pornography might in any way be limited or controlled, you were a totalitarian and you wanted to censor James Joyce. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
But now, of course, that's becoming very much part of the fashion. Women are beginning to realize that, in fact, it's not tolerable.
Mm-hmm. But that impulse is coming from another social
level. That's true. You need social support, exactly. You need social support. And I think in the case of poverty, it may come from a working class poor who, in fact, don't want to be regarded as part of an underclass, don't mm-hmm. want in any way to be associated with that, and would like a reassertion of that kind of individual responsibility.
What about the social values that you see around you now, American social values and attitudes, in comparison with what's happened in Great Britain over the past 50 years, the so-called socialism in Great Britain? Is that happening here?
Well, I'd like to be optimistic about this. I think maybe we've learned a lot from what Britain has been going through. For a long time, Britain was the model upon which we all patterned ourselves. And now I think we are learning what happens when, in fact, you carry out some of these ideas as far as Britain has tried to. On the welfare state, for example, we're being very cautious about it now. Health insurance is a very good example. England went all the way with that, and, you look at the state of English medicine and English hospitals now, and I think we've learned something from that. I think we won't go that route. The trade union movement in England that was able to shut down a major newspaper for almost a year, and even now permits it to come back under very difficult terms. They still will not permit them to introduce modern technological improvements.
Mm.
In any case, I think we've learned from that. So that maybe we won't go the whole route. Maybe England is way out there testing the waters for all kinds of things. We'll learn something from her experience.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Bill Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. I'd like to invite you to listen for Soundings, the Center's radio program. Soundings this week focuses on 100 years of thinking about poverty. Who deserves to have money? How should society treat its poor? Professor Gertrude Himmelfarb of the History Department of the City University of New York has some interesting answers to these questions. Join us this week for Soundings.